Hello, everybody. Welcome to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today, we're talking with Rachel Loudon about the history and philosophy of cuisine. So, there's this thing called New York pizza. It's unlike Chicago pizza, favoring thin crust rather than thick. And it's different than pizza in Italy because it's meant to be served in slices and eaten with your hands. There are many people who think that it's the best pizza in the world, but that's ultimately a matter of taste. What interests me more is that there is a New York pizza at all, that something so Italian can be made so American without any sense of compromise or irony. On the most simplistic level, New York pizza can be explained by Italian immigration around the turn of the 20th century. The word itself has been used in Italy for over 1,000 years, and the first documented American pizzeria appeared in Manhattan in 1905, dead center in the middle wave of Italian relocation. But the idea of a national cuisine was a recent innovation at that point, and if there was one in Italy, it was pasta, not pizza. Even what we think of as pizza, flatbread with marinara and toppings, couldn't have existed without the Americas. The tomato was brought from the New World to Europe 400 years earlier and met significant resistance. Europeans thought it was poisonous. The reality is that we no longer think of pizza as an ethnic food at all. It's basically fast food. And American chains like Domino's and Pizza Hut, possibly the worst pizzas in the world, dominate the international scene with restaurants in over 60 countries. Let's think about the brief history I just offered. To truly understand it, we have to know geography and about three major periods of migration and trade. We have to grasp that vegetation is local but can be relocated. We have to understand basic capitalism, the idea of the nation state, and the concept of a multinational corporation. We have to accept that language changes meaning, as do culinary traditions, and not the least of it, we have to grasp the role of identity and ethnicity in nationalism. That's a lot of background knowledge. Like clothing and music, cuisine is world history writ small. What's particularly interesting about pizza is that it's recognizable by everyone involved. Neapolitans and Sicilians may not like what Americans have done with it, or vice versa, but they'll still understand the dish when they see it. This wouldn't be the case with fortune cookies, which are not from China, but invented in America and modeled on a Japanese cracker, nor fajitas, which are probably from Texas, not Mexico. But pizza is a global food that speaks to the best of our humanity, our ability to combine innovation and tradition and to celebrate a truly cosmopolitan experience. But pizza is just an easy example. All cuisine migrates. Every food is individual, familial, regional, national, imperial, and global. It reminds us that the borders we create are political, not natural, and that there is something arbitrary about the distinction between the American and the Canadian, the Italian and the Spaniard, the Greek and the Turk. I recently asked a Pakistani citizen how his food differed from that of his neighbors, and he responded that, quote, "Pakistani and Indian food are identical twins with different names," unquote. Imagine that. The two countries most likely to destroy each other with nuclear weapons have the same cuisine. Despite their partition and religious conflict, their sustenance unites them. Their food knows no borders, even if they refuse to break bread at the same table. Today's episode is about the history of cooking. We'll look at the philosophy, politics, anthropology, and sociology of cuisine, and we'll try to learn from the changes in food patterns. We'll see how differences in dining are largely a matter of class, not nature, and that access to foodstuffs has been a force of intentional reward and punishment, not just convenience, and social control, not simply personal preference. But in doing so, we're going to have to reconsider how we think about food itself. Cuisine is a tool, no doubt. It's both a fuel and a resource. But it's also art, affection, and more often than not, an object of worship. It is wild yet cultivated, uncontrollable but manipulated, nature and nurture. And not surprisingly, we think about it all the time, but we rarely give it any real thought. And now our guest, Rachel Loudon, is a food historian. She's taught history, philosophy, and science at Carnegie Mellon, University of Pittsburgh, Virginia Tech, the University of Hawaii, and is a visiting scholar at the Latin American Studies Department at the University of Texas, Austin. Her most recent book is Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History. Rachel, welcome to Why.
Jack, it's great to be with you.
The show is being pre-recorded, so we won't be taking questions live. But if you'd like to join the conversation, please visit our chat room at whyradioshow.org, post on Facebook at facebook.com/whyradioshow, or tweet us at whyradioshow. So, Rachel, first, food historian. I mean, how cool is that? I don't know that most people know that that's a job. When did you grow up wanting to be a food historian? When did you discover that you could do that for a living?
Oh, my goodness. It's a very recent... No, it's not so recent. Food history has been around since antiquity. We all tell ourselves stories about the history of our food. But as an academic subject, obviously, it's much newer. I'd always been interested in food, but I didn't want to write a cookbook. I found myself at the University of Hawaii, and the food there was so interesting that I wrote a book about the history of food in Hawaii, and that turned me from a historian of science into a historian of food.
You know, I first heard you on The Splendid Table, and it was one of those classic NPR moments. You were giving an interview, and I couldn't leave the radio. And I just sat there in the parking lot of my gym waiting to hear the end. And then as soon as I was done, I wrote you an email, and you were very gracious, and you agreed to be on the show. And you didn't act at all like it was weird that a philosopher wanted to talk to you about food. Is it strange to think about food philosophically? Is there a role for philosophy in the history of cuisine?
Absolutely. I've been thinking about it that way for years, but because usually we talk about mere cookery and philosophy as part of high culture, miles apart, perhaps I can explain with an analogy. When people celebrate or think about their nation, they don't usually think in terms of high-flown political theory, but of pledges, anthems, parades, even picnics, and in the case of the US, Thanksgiving meals. I'd like to suggest that the way we prepare and consume food is everyday philosophy in the way that people are now talking about those parades and picnics as everyday nationalism. Or to put it in other words, that from the barley bannocks that Socrates praised and the millet porridge that Confucius advocated to the hamburgers that American presidents offer to visiting heads of state, they are all shaped, these meals, by beliefs about what cooking is, about how cuisine is related to society, to the natural world, including our own bodies, and to the moral or supernatural or spiritual world, depending on how you conceive that.
So the way that we think about food is already laden with our philosophical orientation to the world, to our religion, to our families, that food is not a category in and of itself, but rather something that we need to filter through our understanding.
Absolutely. It is filtered through our understanding. When we eat something that has been transformed. We don't eat plants and we don't eat animals. Occasionally we'll have a nibble of something raw, but basically all our calories come from something that we have radically changed from the way it was in nature. So we have created our food. Our food is not a natural product. It's a human product. It's as human as clothing or, as you said in the introduction, as music. And the way we shape it, the way we transform it, depends on our broader social, intellectual, moral goals.
Right. So Aristotle struggled with this distinction between a natural thing and an artifact. And an artifact for him was something that human beings have adjusted. And so food in itself is something that we've adjusted, the food stuff. When you talk about early foods and foods eaten raw, you make a point in the book that even the vegetables that we think of as vegetables have evolved through human intervention. Let's say, I don't think you mentioned the carrot, but let's say the carrot is very different than it was 10,000 years ago, the squash, if there was a squash, was very different. And so even the very basic foodstuffs that we have are human artifacts to a certain extent. Is that right?
To a very large extent. You know, plants aren't just sitting there waiting to be eaten. They have a whole set of defensive strategies, mainly produced either by being very tough and covered in nasty little inedible husks and shells, or by being poisonous. And I think it's interesting that in the ancient world, there's a lot of evidence that people thought that farming or cultivating was in fact a way or a preliminary to or part of the cooking or preparation process, that you are changing through breeding your plants and animals to be softer, more digestible, or less poisonous.
Does this mean that something like the paleo diet is, let's say, philosophically incoherent, that this notion that we're supposed to eat like cave people ate is just inherently impossible, because even the broccoli and the lettuce and the stuff that my wife and I pull from our productive garden in the backyard during the, you know, 4.5 days that we have summer here in North Dakota, that doesn't resemble the original foodstuffs. And so the idea of eating a paleo diet is inherently impossible?
Essentially, yes. Most of the plants and most of the animals that we eat are very different from what they would have been 20,000 years ago. Perhaps fish are not so terribly different. They're probably pretty much the same, but most things are different. And it's also arbitrary to pick there are many problems with the Paleolithic diet. It's impossible. It's arbitrary to pick that one moment in time as being when we were kind of natural humans as opposed to any other time. And it's also very clear that Paleolithic peoples who needed calories as much as we do, when they could get hold of carbohydrates, were quite happy to eat them.
So why, I guess that leads to the necessary question of why do we cook? The paleo folks and other people as well have raw food diets and all of this sort of stuff, but cooking was really important, right? I mean, what does cooking provide that human beings couldn't get before the discovery of cooking?
Cooking makes foods less poisonous in general. It makes foods more digestible. It softens foods. And it makes foods tastier. It gives them a longer shelf life. The advantages of cooking are enormous. That's not to say there aren't sometimes some disadvantages. Sometimes we can lose nutrients. Sometimes we can introduce new dangers. There's always a trade-off in human life. But the trade-off that humans have chosen is, and chose many thousands of years ago, is that we were going to cook our food. And people who have looked into groups that try to exist entirely on raw food find that it's almost impossible for them to stay healthy. So at some point, we crossed the Rubicon, so to speak, and we became the animals that cooked. We became the animals that created our food, that didn't just take what nature offered.
And that I guess, leads to my next question, which is, okay, so the foodstuffs have changed because of human intervention. Have humans changed because we cooked? Are humans in some sense very different physiologically, biologically, psychologically, because we are the animals that cook? Or did we just stay basically the same and just discover our nature or become a more efficient, more nutrient-gathering creature?
This is an area of very active research at the moment. Some scholars want to say that it was, in fact, the fact that we didn't have to spend so much energy digesting, and digesting still takes a huge amount of human energy. that allowed us to direct more calories to the brain and therefore develop bigger brains. People have speculated that our teeth are smaller because we don't have to chew so hard. It's very clear that humans adjusted to milk diets with the arrival of dairying. Yes, we are the creation of our created food as much as we have created that food.
You said something in passing that I think is worth calling attention to. You said digesting takes a huge amount of energy. I mean, we've all had that experience, right? We've all had of eating a huge meal, sometimes healthy, oftentimes not, and just sitting there and being, just groaning. And I think it's a good moment to notice how little we actually think about the food. We only think about it when we face resistance, or when it's not there, or when it feels like it's attacking us from the inside. If digestion takes so much energy, and if eating too much can cause such difficulties, why do we eat so much? Where does this desire come from to consume more and more and more and more? Is it just taste? Is it habit? Is it social expectation at a Super Bowl party?
I think it's all those things. And I think one of the interesting things is that nowadays our food is so digestible that we don't spend a lot of time thinking about the process that our bodies go through once we have ingested food. If you go back in history and you go back to antiquity or even to the late Middle Ages or the Renaissance, much of what doctors are doing, for those who can afford them, is carefully monitoring the passage of food through the body because it wasn't so digestible then. And so they would examine the feces to see if they were coming out right and worry about how fast people or slowly people could digest. We have largely abandoned those worries, except when we need a Pepto-Bismol.
You have in the book a mention, you don't describe it, and I'm grateful for that, of the person whose job it was to examine, I think it was the emperor's feces, to see if the emperor's food is treating the emperor right, and if it's suitable for this individual person. And this isn't, of course, just about food. This is about the idea of cuisine. And I've been asking you all about food, but really, your book is a history of cooking, a history of cuisine, a history of diets. How important is this difference, this distinction between food as an object of consumption and cuisine, this system of how we think about, how we eat, how we present, how we prepare, how we give food? How important is that distinction?
I think it is important. Animals, in a certain sense, eat food and we eat cuisines. Food, you know, obviously it's something that gives you nutrients. You come across it. If, you know, if there's an animal out there wandering, it'll eat when it gets food. It will sleep when it's finished eating. Then it will go searching for food again. As soon as you start cooking takes so much human energy. It's essentially pre-digesting. So you've got to do a huge amount of time and work. And that means that you begin structuring your food in various ways. First, if you find one technique for turning raw materials into food, plants and animals into food, then you will try it on every other plant and animal to see if it works for them too. So you begin to get patterns of cooking. Because it's so time-consuming, it makes more sense to assemble it in meals instead of eating at random through the day. So you get socialization, you get groups gathering to eat together as the most efficient way, and then gradually, and I'm speculating here because we don't have direct evidence of the first meals, but then beginning to see that meals are a way of structuring social relations and political relations. So I think the notion that cuisines, which for me doesn't mean high cuisine, it just simply means a style of cooking, a particular way of preparing and serving and eating food, we can understand the development of human cooking and eating habits through a very small number of very wide-ranging cuisines.
And after the break, which will take in just a couple minutes, I want to ask you about those social structures and about the mode of presentation and all the things that you just mentioned. But I want to I was talking to some people before the show, and even though it's pre-recorded, we have a couple questions. And one of the questions comes from Kim, who asks about the Southern dish Brunswick stew, which was originally made with squirrel, and which now is made with other meats, in part because our relationship with the squirrel has changed. It's changed in terms of classes. It's changed in terms of animals that we like or not like to eat. And so the question that she has is, which comes first? The change in the relationship with the animal, we feel a certain way about alligators, we feel a certain way about horses, we feel a certain way about crickets, and therefore we eat them or don't eat them, or the decision to include them in the cuisine, and therefore that then changes how we think about the animal.
Let me come at this from a slightly different direction.
Okay.
Take insects, which are one of the great taboos in the West. Insects were highly valued in ancient Mesopotamia. A grilled locust or a grilled grasshopper was a delicacy, and there are, you know, lots of engravings and carvings of people with grilled grasshoppers on a stick. And then when you get a change in a shift towards the Zoroastrian religion, there becomes a set of beliefs that insects are nasty, crawling creatures representative of evil. And at that point, insects drop out of the cuisine. You can tell much the same story about horse and Christian cuisine.
So, and we'll talk about this soon, this idea of the culinary cosmos, that nature has an order of things. But what you're suggesting is that the religious foundations for the food assign goodness and evil to these animals. And so we didn't eat them because we didn't want that evil entering into our body. We eat the good things in order to become good. We avoid the evil things in order to become evil.
I think that's the general rule, yes.
So when we come back, I want to talk about the religious aspects, the goodness and evil, the culinary cosmos, if I forget to ask you that, please remind me, and also the shift later on in more modern times to a national cuisine, because the way that we think about cuisine, of course, is very different from the pre-modern world. But before we do that, we have to take a break. You're listening to Rachel Loudon and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back in a moment.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Jack Russell Weinstein and Rachel Loudon on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We're talking about Rachel's book, Cuisine and Empire, The History of Food and the Philosophical, Religious, and Political Causes and Implications of All of That. And I want to talk for a second about an experience I had last year at what has become maybe my favorite restaurant. This restaurant, tiny little restaurant in New York City called the Piccolo Cafe. It's on 79th Street and Columbus, and you should all go. They're not paying me or anything, but if they want to, they can. And we were there for the first time last year, and I had linguine and clam sauce, which for those of you who know, is really the ultimate test of what good pasta is. And my wife loves to tell the story. I took a bite and I literally started to cry. The food was so good and I had missed this level of quality Italian cuisine so much that I just started to tear up. I couldn't believe it. I got angry at my life, at geography, at all these sorts of things. And I was just overwhelmed. And of course, I'm the kind of person that tells the wait staff. So our waitress, who was actually a young Dominican woman who grew up in the same neighborhood that I did, Washington Heights, we had a great conversation with her, and they brought up the pasta chef from the basement, who is now apparently the pastry chef. Her name, great name, Chiquita Coffee. And she's a young light-skinned black woman from Chicago whose fantasy is to own a food truck that makes, when we talked to her, chili. So, and she gave me this recipe and we talked for a while. And so I'm in this New York Italian restaurant with a Dominican waitress and a light-skinned black Chicagoan as the pasta chef. And I have this experience of food that is so overwhelming that I can't control myself emotionally. And that we've talked about for a year after. And we actually went back this spring break and it's still just as good. And I don't know if that I could parse the story in any really meaningful way other than personal therapy. And so, Rachel, the question that I have for you, which is not a therapeutic one, although I can get on the couch if you want me to, is how do I think about that experience to give credit to both the historical structures that got us to where we are, but also the meaning structures, the layers and layers and layers of relationship that I have with the food, my personal history, the pleasure. I know this is a sort of awkward question, or awkwardly framed, but how do I start thinking about cuisine or a particular meal in such a way that I can both give credit to the actual history and the meaning behind that history?
My goodness, that's a facer of a question.
Sorry about that.
Yes. Let me just go to my own experience. I mean, my experience is that I find food is much more interesting, much richer when I can tell myself a story about the history, just as I find if I go to a musical performance, I know something about the traditions out of which this music comes. That doesn't mean that I can't have the kind of transcendent experience that you had, where you are really overwhelmed by sound or taste or something. Those moments, I don't know quite how to prepare for or even how to pause. They don't come along very often, and one's grateful when they do. Most of life is a little bit more mundane than that, and at that point I find that appreciation of the broader context of the food really enhances the experience.
I have to say, in the back of my head, I think I said 79th Street. It's 75th Street. I don't want people to go to the wrong restaurant. But if you're in Manhattan right now. But,
I'm going next week. Jotted it down.
Absolutely go. But so is... You tell yourself you're very interested in the stories, and that makes sense because, of course, you're a historian. I don't know which came first, you being a historian or the interest in the stories. I suspect it's the interest in the stories. But most of our experience of history is transcendent, right? Most of our experience of history is intuitive. When we see a person in an outfit, when we see a kind of building, when we engage in certain language, or in the case of the discussion today, when we participate in cuisine, history is invisible to us, right? Isn't that part of the power of history, that it's so – that exists so much on the subconscious that we don't have to be aware of it to have that relationship?
I think we need to be aware of it. Otherwise, we get caught up in terrible traps.
Okay.
And I think it's the job of the historian to help people understand the bigger traps. Food at the moment has become a kind of way of thinking about politics and the world and economics. And it's flying high. Every newspaper, every magazine, even philosophy radio shows mm-hmm. are talking about food. And I feel at the moment that many of the ideas that are being bruited around could really do with a bit of a dose of history.
How much of that is history and how much of that is what in the profession gets called historiography? How much of that is what actually happened and how much of that is the stories that we decide to tell about what actually happened? Is there a way to distinguish? And when you were doing this massive amount of research, I can't the readers pick up the book. It's a spectacularly written book. I told you, Rachel, in an email, and I'll tell everyone at home that the introduction to the book is one of the best introductions that I've ever read to an academic book. It's spectacularly written, wonderfully organized, but yet in the midst of all these sweeping transitional descriptions, you have all of this detail and all these accounts of what specific food people ate where and how much it cost and all of this sort of stuff. There are all these facts, there are all these details, there are all these things, but they have to be united by a story, right? So how do you decide upon, or how do you discover? And I guess the question ultimately is, do you decide upon or do you discover the historiographic organization of the information that you want to tell?
Oh, that's the trick. I mean, I beat my head for years over this. I thought I would never get through it. Do you start with farming? Do you start with the meal? Do you organize by nation? Do you organize by region? I decided that starting with farming was hopeless. I decided that organizing it just by nation was hopeless. And only when I could break out of our current assumptions that national foods are the way to tell the story, that beginning with agriculture is the way to tell the story, could I make any headway? And I will talk a little bit about natural if you want, because I think that would illustrate some of the points you're trying to get at.
Absolutely. But let me interject before a second. If I were writing a book review, the way that I sort of understood the book to be organized is by tracing the comparison between what you call high, low, and middling food or middling cuisines. What I really latched onto anyway as the reader is that if we want to understand the changes of cuisine throughout history, we have to understand that there is this elite cuisine that – for the most of human history, people – well, actually, let me have you, the expert, do this. But what is high, low, and eventually middling cuisine, and why is it so important to the story?
It's so important because we live in the most extraordinary period of human history in the last 20,000 years from the point of view of food. What happened when we decided to eat cooked food was that basically the only kind of food that could sustain large states and therefore large civilizations, which I simply mean city-based societies, were grains. Grains have a lot of calories, they're easy to transport and store, and they can be turned into an extraordinary range of different dishes, from alcohol, oil, and sugar to bread, pasta, and cake. So grains it was. And this begins happening about 20,000 years ago. But the bargain, the sort of devil side of the bargain with the grains is that because grains are easy to to store, they become wealth. And with grain civilizations, you get a split in society into a relatively small elite class and a very large 90% of the population group of people laboring largely to provide the surplus food to support this tiny elite.
And the other aspect of grains that you talk about is that grains are heavy, that they're very hard to transport. And so this is why cities, or at least one of the main reasons why cities are located by water, and that if you transport grains by horse, you have to feed the horse. And I don't recall this being in the book, but for those folks who live in more rural areas and for our North Dakota audience, you'll notice that many communities tend to be about 20 miles away from one another, because 20 miles is the distance that you could go in a day with a horse while carrying enough foodstuffs for yourselves and enough stuff to feed the horse. So so the devil's bargain is not just maybe it's not a devil's bargain, but the logistics is not just that you have the storage, but that you have to transport it and you have to get it to places. And that means that we have to gather in large-scale communities just because we didn't have the transport the ability to transport them, right?
Yes, and that we can only have relatively small cities until steam power becomes available, and then you can get the food in by train, steamship, now by container.
And so then, so you have these cities, and you have this high cuisine, which identifies the wealthy, which is to a very limited population. Then you have the low cuisine, which is everyone else, even if they're lucky, right? The people who are lucky get nothing. And then, if I understood you correctly, the line between the pre-modern and the modern is this invention of this thing called middling cuisine, which I guess we would think about as the middle class. What's middling cuisine and why does it change things?
I prefer to call low cuisines humble cuisines because they can be very high quality. They are very limited. You're basically going to be eating just tortillas or brown bread. But if you only eat that or you only eat that with a bit of sauce, you pay great attention to it, so that the tortillas or the bread may be very, very good. But what you don't have is meat, oil, fruits and vegetables, or exotic goods from afar. Those are reserved for people in the high cuisines, and they use them to make sauces and sweets, which are typical of high cuisines. What happens in the 19th century, as you move to more egalitarian societies, whether they are liberal, democratic, or socialist, is that by a matter of both design and lucky coincidence, we have a fall in the price of food and a greater accessibility of food thanks to transport and industrialization, so that vast numbers of people in the United States, essentially everybody, can eat what had formerly been reserved for the elite. And you might sum that up as a hamburger and a milkshake. Meat, white bread, milk, and sugar, with a little bit of lettuce.
I want to talk about that and about the industrialization of food. And I want to actually talk about in a second about the cost of food. But before I do that, one of the other things that surprised me in the book was that this notion of, I'll call it an industrial kitchen, but what it really is a large-scale kitchen, is much older than the family meal. That in these great cities, in the Roman army, that there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people who were working in a kitchen. And so most of human history is large-scale kitchen and large-scale cooking. And this thing that we think of as everyone with their own cooking, everyone with their own fire, everyone with their own family, that's a very recent and a very limited invention, right? So tell us a little bit about how things were cooked throughout human history in pre-modern, and then we'll talk for a second about French cuisine.
Okay. rural people, the wife was the cook. The humble cuisines, the woman always was the cook, and that was fairly small scale. But for the king, the emperor, the general, the aristocrat, the kitchen was an arm of government. And it employed hundreds or thousands of workers who used their own physical labor to turn food into raw materials into food. It was an arm of government partly because most revenue came in kind as raw materials, grains, or exotic goods from afar, and they had to be processed by somebody. The palace becomes a value-adding, or the palace kitchens add value by processing them, and then they use them to pay in kind the king's crack troops, his bureaucrats, the palace staff. They also use them to demonstrate that the king has the power to command these revenues in kind and to demonstrate his magnificence in huge feasts. So cooking was not incidental to early states. It was absolutely central.
And it was also essential to armies, right? I mean, there's the famous line that an army travels on its stomach. But
yeah.
I think my favorite fun fact from the book is you're talking about the Roman army, and I may get the numbers wrong, but I think that a Roman soldier, that the Romans carried with them grindstones, and that one Roman soldier's job was to grind the wheat for, I think you said, an hour, and then each in an hour that soldier could grind enough flour for 8 soldiers. And so out of a campaign of about, I think you said, maybe a half a million Roman soldiers, that they're traveling with 30,000 grindstones.
At its height, yes, the Roman army was about that. Those figures are about right. So yes, grindstones were essential to the Roman army. And it's why they were so efficient, because armies until then had relied on women camp followers to do the grinding. And that means that you've got an awful lot more people to feed. You can't move as fast. So the fact that the Roman army chooses to make its soldiers do their own grinding, which is something that normally only slaves or women or slaves who were women did, was a huge breakthrough.
And then the folks in the cities at various different periods in history, a lot of people ate in communal kitchens. A lot of people had takeout, right? Takeout is not a modern invention, I gather. Takeout made me think of actually the kids' movie Kung Fu Panda, where the main character and his father own a noodle shop, right? This notion of restaurants, of takeout food, of a large amount of your food not being made by your family unit, at least in urban life, that's as old as cities itself.
It's absolutely as old as cities. Cities always have a disproportionate number of young men. It's difficult to get fuel into the cities. Imagine carrying in the wood that you need to cook. It's difficult to distribute water in cities very often. And so it makes an awful lot of sense to have your food preparation done commercially. And that's what happened in many, many cities.
Now, let's compare that with the high cuisine and what high cuisine looks like, and particularly when French culture and French cooking becomes the dominant notion. And you have in the book, I want to read the whole thing, but I'm not going to. You have this account of what it costs to run a French kitchen. French cuisine did not come cheap. The cost of meaty reductions in fine wines offset any savings from the elimination of expensive imported spices. The salaries of well-known cooks, many of them now independent for the guilds, were sky high. The Duke of Newcastle, reputedly one of only 5 people in Europe to own a solid gold dinner service, paid his French celebrity cook £105 a year, when most French cooks in England receive £40. And then you have here's for serving coffee, one noble Swedish family spent about 1,000 Swedish silver thalers, about $10,000 US today, on a silver pot. Chinese porcelain cups, perhaps specially ordered from China, a painted and lacquered round table, a handful steel grinder, a silver tray, and linen cloths. Catherine the Great paid Josiah Wedgwood £2,700, perhaps $250,000 today. The 1%, right? We talk about the 1% in the United States now. The 1% has always been the 1%. And food, if I understand the book correctly, is both the thing that identifies and also divides the 1%. That cuisine helps declare who is in what caste and how?
Oh, absolutely. You know, nowadays, when I say that middling cuisines are available to all Americans, people say, oh, you must realize we've got a class structure in America. And of course we do. There are some really, really wealthy people, and there are some people who are really, really struggling. But there are very few people in America who cannot afford to or are not prepared to be seen eating a hamburger. A hamburger is your perfect example of middling cuisine. U.S. presidents, are seen on campaign eating hamburgers. In the past, a king would never have, or imagine the Queen of England standing up outside a McDonald's. It wouldn't happen. In the past, the aristocracy, the way they ate was the way they deliberately distinguished themselves from other people. Yes.
And this is, of course, why there are now $1,000, $5,000 hamburgers at fancy restaurants. It gives, at these, two or three fancy restaurants that get all the news when it's covered, where they have like gold leaf on the bun, that it gives the current aristocracy the permission to eat the delicious hamburger because they're willing to make it into high cuisine, right?
Right. Now in the past, what gave this particular power was that people really did believe you were what you ate. So if you ate like an animal, if you ate raw food, you become an animal. If you ate like a peasant, that is brown bread and root vegetables, you'd become a peasant. If you ate like a king, you'd become a king. Now we have lost that, thank goodness, we've lost that physiological theory that underpinned these distinctions. So people now will accuse the diner who takes a, $100 hamburger of being an elitist. But the assumption is that in the end, he can be full or she can be folded back into American society.
And so this notion of you are what you eat, this is part of what you call the culinary cosmos. The three culinary principles of the ancient world, you argue, are that there's a hierarchy, that food is a sacrificial bargain, that you have to sacrifice some, that the food is actually ritualistic and part of the religious practices, and then that there's this culinary cosmos where not only you are what you eat, but you have charts in the book of what happens to food and then to people. And then the process of not necessarily reincarnation, but certainly the process. And then it shifts in what I will admit was my favorite page in the book, page 208 for all of those following at home, where you talk about the social contract and how when modern political philosophy invents really the idea that government is the product of the consent of the governed, then all of a sudden, not letting people eat certain kinds of food ceases to be philosophically coherent, and then instead is a remnant of the old world. And what you need is a unifying cuisine, at least in theory, to announce and to undergird the fact that the individual people are the source of governance, not divine right, not metaphysics.
Exactly. And it's not an accident that the right to vote goes more or less in lockstep with the ability of these societies to provide middling cuisines to everybody, because you can't have a democratic, or if you want to include them, a socialist society that argues that the people are important, if you continue to have this not just a division between richer food and poorer food. That's not the issue. Obviously, people will always pay more for certain kinds of food, but a whole system of theory that undergirds the fact that there is a real distinction between the ruling class and the rest of us.
And then from this point, right, so we've gone from the ancient notions of the religious service inherent in food in this culinary cosmos to this individual liberal notion of the consent of the governed. And then you start to get the nation states. And so I have two questions in one, and they're bigger questions. But at what point do we get the sense of a national cuisine, and why was there no national cuisine beforehand? And implicit in that is, the name of your book is Cuisine and Empire. Why did you choose to focus on empire as opposed to countries, nation states, individual communities?
Well, nation states, of course, are very late. There were a few city states in Greece or in Renaissance Italy. But if you're looking at the big political units in history, most of them are empires. And I take a very loose definition of empire as a political power that can extend its power over a vast geographical range, or its economic power. So there aren't, the crucial distinction until very recently was between classes or castes, as historians sometimes like to call them now. So that when French cuisine goes around the world in the 18th and early 19th century, it doesn't matter. The Japanese emperor eats French cuisine. Latin American millionaires eat French cuisine. Czars eat French cuisine. And they all see themselves as part of a ruling group. High French cuisine was not the cuisine of the French people. Most French people never saw it. It's only when you get the political changes following the French Revolution and the gradual establishment of more and more nation states that the nation becomes the focus.
I want to go back. I want to shift back to some foundational questions. And in particular, I want to ask a very basic question. I'll tell you why I'm asking this. I want to ask, what is food? And one of the reasons why I'm asking this, connecting to the conversations we're having, is that you point out at one point that Jesuits declared that chocolate wasn't food. And they declared it because then they could eat it on fast days. Now, as someone who observes Yom Kippur, I am all in favor of this Jesuit tradition. They also run really good universities. So is food anything, we'll say edible, that someone declares it to be? Or is there an objective, independent, non-relative definition of food past edibility?
Past edibility. No, I think it changes over time. In the ancient world, for example, food... The defining character of food for most of the ancient world was that it had been cooked. And the more it had been cooked, the better, because it was the furthest from raw, crude, unformed nature. We don't have that definition of food now. We're quite happy. In fact, we rather celebrate eating fresh, natural, raw food. So I think as culinary philosophies change, the notion of what is acceptable food changes, whether it's insects and horses or chocolate or raw. It's highly dependent on the cultural setting.
And so that leads me to another question, which is, why aren't drugs food? And I ask this because it probably wouldn't have occurred to me, but in one sentence, you mention in passing marijuana, and you mention a group of people that they're eating a bunch of things, and in a parenthetical comment, you mention marijuana. you talk about alcohol throughout the entire book. Different forms of alcohol, beer, of course, proved a nutritious element in early history. Wine is ever present. Intoxication is ever present, and there are different religious attitudes about intoxication. But there's no mention of the category that we call drugs, which is often herbal, and mushrooms and things like that. So are drugs food? And if not, why not?
It depends when you are. I struggled about how much of this to include. I felt I had to include alcohol because it has been regarded as a food. I wanted to include air, which many people have regarded as a food in the past, and we wouldn't now. Air fed the brain. Drugs, too. There have been different classifications at different periods of time about what does and doesn't go in the food category. And I don't think there is a a timeless distinction. I mean, if you want to try for one, it's something that offers nutrition. But then does air offer nutrition? Does water offer nutrition? Many people thought so in the past, and there are, you know, they're certainly necessary for the body in certain kinds of ways. As we learn about micronutrients, many things that might not have been thought of as food might come into the food category. I think there is not a simple and straightforward answer to that question.
I'm stuck on the concept of air as food because my initial reaction was, well, that's ridiculous. There's no nutritional value in food in air. But then, of course, I think about all of the things we do to buy and sell air in our community, right? Forget air conditioning and air filters and things like that, but canned air for computers. Talk a little bit more about air as food. It's fascinating.
Well, one of the things that's interested me is that in the Western tradition, in Western cuisine, we have a fascination with air. We have puffy cakes and meringues that have been risen with air. We have puffy white bread, not flat bread. We have fizzy drinks. We have fizzy champagne. And why is this? And I'm toying with an idea. I've written it up a bit. That one of the reasons is that there was a belief that air really was a nutrient. 200 or 300 years ago, and people began experimenting with different ways of getting air into food if they believe the Western nutritional theory. Once you get a new technique, raised bread or baking powder to raise cakes, well, then if it produces nice stuff, then it tends to go on even after the theory that started it has vanished.
Well, Rob, I'm thinking about foam, which is I don't know if it's still all the rage, but for a while it was all the rage. I'm thinking about aroma and how different foods smell and different ways that you serve mm-hmm. foods. The brandy snifter, right? Think about mm-hmm. I'm thinking about air and the brandy snifter, where part of drinking the alcohol is the consuming of the air. I mean, this is one of those moments, right? I mean, air wasn't in the book. And this is one of those moments where you've said something and just it opens up a huge thread of discussion from puffy cakes and popcorn to just what are those little things that you plug in and make your house smell a certain way, right? I mean, so this really does open the definition of food to a whole different level and changes also the meaning of nutrition because, of course, wellness and mindfulness and the humors in old-fashioned language, all these different things that were considered a part of physiological health that we now put in a different category. Ultimately, it's all Descartes' fault, like everything else, because of the distinction between the mind and the body. Mm-hmm. And of course, you point that Descartes and Laplace and others, they objected to the expense of meals, and they objected to some of the shifting structures, right? And there was a call for a more stoic, a more ancient, a classical Greek return to food.
I think, I mean, when people began, when the political systems in Europe began to shift in the 18th century, people looked to the past and they looked to the Roman Republic, the period that preceded the Roman Empire, because that was one of the times in human history when people had thought about a different kind of set of culinary structures from high and humble cuisines. And they had argued for what they called republican cuisines, where food was to be fuel for the body, it was to build strong citizens. The Roman army is founded very much on the and fed on these principles. And they criticize high cuisine as being frivolous, luxurious, and actually so expensive as to be damaging to the state. And that's not an entirely outrageous claim when you look at the cost of meals, whether it was in the Roman Empire or whether it's in Louis XIV's court. The cost of court meals was absolutely outstandingly extravagant.
And this, of course, is not just class, but it's also identity, which of course is intertwined with class, mm-hmm. because the Republicans wanted Republican citizens. They wanted virtuous citizens that attached themselves to a conception of virtue. And I think the place where we see this still today is in kosher laws. You point out that while there are some people who argue that the formation of kosher laws and the prohibition of pork is about trigonosis and proper cooking, that at least you suggest that it's about identity formation and distinguishing the Jew from other people, that this kind of culinary restriction shows you are this group and not that group. And then at a different point, you talk about Buddhists in 250 BCE being the first group to become, you don't use this word, but evangelical, to go out and convert people. And then you say that has a tremendous impact on world cuisine, the need to convert people to the Buddhist religion.
Yes, it does. I mean,
why?
It transforms the cuisine of the whole of East Asia and Southeast Asia, because the missionaries go out, they establish monasteries with processing facilities, they have a new physiology, they have a new theory of how you should eat, they emphasize white rice, sugar, meat avoidance, and you get the development of cuisines that develop, say, in China, all the mock meats that we now eat, gluten, seitan, tofu, and that kind of thing.
How important are cookbooks? I mean, Leviticus outlines what you're supposed to eat in the kosher law, under kosher law, and there are Buddhist texts and Hindu texts outlining in great details this vegetable or that vegetable, eat this way, eat that way. But these are not cookbooks, right? How important are cookbooks, and were they always this instruction as to how to cook, or were they more philosophical in nature? Are cookbooks the philosophical guide to cuisine?
Contemporary cookbooks, no. Their function has varied over time. You do get recipes from very early on, and they're mainly to make sure that you keep the sacrificial process and the sacrificial feast along the correct lines. Then you get the court cookbooks of the major Eurasian courts, and those are largely to memorialize and celebrate the extravagant meals of the ruler and hence his power. Then you get in this sort of republican period in the 18th and 19th century, the practical how-to cookbook to help people who are moving from rural, humble cuisines to be able to create middling cuisines in their own kitchen. And to just sort of play off that for a second, you're talking about the creation of middling cuisines and identity. And there was this debate in the United States in the 19th century about what kind of meal Thanksgiving should be. Should it be a high French meal, or should it be a regular family meal of the kind advocated by the precursors to the home economics movement? And of course, they opted for the family meal of affordable foods. And it was a quite unique moment in history, because to choose what is just simply a sort of slightly elaborate form of the everyday family meal as the national meal is a very strong political statement.
And yet at the same time, there is now a certain kind of reticence amongst many for the gluttonous aspect of the Thanksgiving meal. We do, every year we do a 23, 24 person Thanksgiving meal. I cook for 3 days, and it's my favorite holiday. But there are definitely moments when I look at all this food and I think, this is morally unjustifiable. Right? So even though the Thanksgiving meal was itself a response, a moderating response, it's not maybe as moderate as some moral systems would demand.
That could certainly be, but it's still the case, even now, that neither the ingredients, turkey, sweet potatoes, nor the ingredients are not the more expensive ones,
right,
and the techniques are not the more elaborate ones. The most elaborate bit is the gravy, but that's a very, a sauce most people can manage. So it's chiefly in the quantity that it tends to go over the top.
And then this appeals to, again, the question of the types of food and accessibility, because following this discussion in the 19th century is the shift to a discussion of what kind of foods are best for war, right? You have this line that there's this notion that a diet determines a nation's strength. What does that mean, that a diet determines a nation's strength?
Well, I think we still believe it to a large extent. Traditionally, the main question about the strength of the nation was the strength of the king and the strength of the king's army. It was a personal matter. So all the effort went into making the strong upper class. But once you move again into democracies, it is the case that people begin to think that the strength of the nation depends on the strength of all the citizens of that nation, particularly those who are doing physical work on farms, in factories, or in the army. And so there begins to be a vast investigation of surveys of people's diets, worries about the diet. Michelle Obama, when she worries about in her introductory statement when she launched the Let's Move movement, buys into this tradition by talking about, worries about being able to have a strong American army if our children are obese.
And is this was another question that came up when I was talking to people about the show in advance. Is this concern about obesity unique to the contemporary world? And is it because everyone has access to the middling foods, or is it because the middling foods themselves are higher fat, higher salt, than higher carb than most people have had access to? Is the obesity discussion, first of all, philosophically, what do you think is happening? Is this about nation strength, or are there other things going on? And is it a unique discussion for our time, or does it have precursors?
Well, there have always been obese people, but they were always the rich people.
Right. I always tell my students that these generations, this is the first time in human history that the poor have been fat, and that the wealthy, that thinness and fitness is a sign of leisure now, as opposed to a sign of
exactly. There's been a kind of 180 degree turn on that. So it as a mass problem, it's a new one. It's not peculiar to the United States. We've got to learn to live. Food is very difficult. You either have to, if you have too much money, you can, put it in the bank. If you have too much food, there's nowhere to go. But if you'd have too little, you don't have any reserves and you can't keep food for a long time. So it's better to have too much, I think, than to have too little. We don't have more carbs than in the past. We have we eat a far lower proportion of carbs. What we have much more of is fat, sugar, and meat. And this is really the first generation, the first couple of generations that have had to deal with this. It's going to take a while to work out. But tragic as it is for the people who suffer from really chronic obesity, it's a better state of the world than having mass starvation.
And you talk, when you're reviewing British cuisine in the 19th century that gets such a bad rap, you spend a fair amount of time defending it and saying that at least for the urban classes, they were better off than they had ever been in history. So what then marks contemporary cuisine? What makes the cuisine of 2015? We're 15, right? 2015 different than the cuisine of 1910?
It's really a continuation, I think, of the 1910 cuisine. The really, really, really huge change to modern cuisines in Western European countries and to some extent in Japan and Latin America came between 1880 and 1920. That's when people learnt to use fossil fuels, power to process food for the first time, the industrialization of food, the rethinking of a philosophy of food that said that everybody should have a decent diet, the work on calories and on nutritional content. Much of that became into effect in that period. And where we are now is in a period when all that, those changes that took place at the turn of the beginning of the 20th century are now not only being sort of fully implemented in the United States, but spreading around very large parts of the world. The number of parts of the world that still have high and humble cuisines is now tiny, whereas it was still very substantial 110 years ago.
So we're running out of time, and I want to ask one last question. It's a bigger question, but I think that it encapsulates one of the central ideas of the book that will help people tie up all the ends of this discussion. You say, I think it's on page 166, you say, without a powerful state, there will be no effect on cuisine. Now, you say this in passing. You're talking about the cuisines of other Christian groups, such as Egyptian Copts and Turks and Syrians, Indians and Cathars in the 12th century, southern France. And then you say, I leave these to one side because in the absence of a powerful state backing, they have had less effect on the global culinary history.
Okay, fine. Mm. Yes. There are all kinds of interesting and intriguing tiny cuisines by particular groups that have particular ideas, religious or political or nutritional, what have you. But if you are going to have an effect on a very large part of the world's population, then it's through political and economic and military power that cuisines spread over large areas. That's simply what I meant.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, Rachel, this has been a great discussion. I can't tell you how much I learned from the book, and it's made me look at
everything in a different way. In this conversation, I'm going to be thinking about air for a really long time. So I think you should pursue that project, because I think it would be fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Okay. I very much enjoyed it. Thank you, Jack.
You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Rachel Loudon on Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back with some more thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
We're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with Rachel Loudon about her book, Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History. It is a history of cooking. And one would think off the top of our heads that cooking has nothing to do with philosophy. But of course, what she has shown us is that cooking has everything to do with philosophy, that the distinction between food and not food is philosophical. The distinction between meals and not meals is philosophical. And we didn't really talk about it, but the distinction between cooking and not cooking is also philosophical, because there are some ways to cook, quote unquote, without heat. You can put fish in lime juice, for example, and that is considered to be cooking. So once again, we see that the philosophical structures underpin how we see the world. We also see particularly that food doesn't have a life of its own, that there isn't this thing called food that we have to respond to, but rather what we consider to be food, what we consider to be meals, what we consider to be cuisine is a human invention, and it moves as we move, as our religions change, our attitudes change, as our rituals change, our behaviors change, as our nations change, as our technologies change, the things that we consider food and the way that we present it change. The family meal is not the oldest meal in human history. The collective meal is, the military meal is, and the religious meal is. Food as ritual. And one of the great changes in human history was the secularization of food, moving away from this notion that food has to be sacrificed to the gods and eaten as a sign of obedience and virtue, to food being a nutrient for an individual, food being a personal decision, food being a representative of national culture. It is odd to me, and I'm always surprised by how the things that are most important to us are the things that we give the least attention to, at least the least intellectual attention. It takes a specialist, someone like Rachel Loudon, a food historian who is also trained in philosophy, by the way, to presented in such a way that reveals all of the things that seem so obvious after she says it. Things that seem that cuisine is different than food, that air, it can be thought of as a consumable, that we get to decide what to eat based on how we feel about what to eat. This book is a tour de force. It is a world history. It teaches you about so much else. In addition to food, it is accessible, it is easy to read, it is super fun. It's long, but it's worth it. Once again, I'm walking away from a show with a different attitude about a daily activity. I don't think, and I hope I won't, that I don't think I will ever look at the meal the same way again. And that is a great gift that I received from our guest and from all of you. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. As always, it's an honor to be here.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.